Today is October 9th, 2025, here in Juneau, Alaska, with Larry Spengler. And we're for the Subsistence Research Legacy Project. I'm also joined here in Juneau by Jim Fall. And then Bill Schneider is on the phone from Fairbanks, listening in and maybe asking us a few questions. So, Larry, thank you.
Sure.
For your time today. And just to get us started before we dive into subsistence, is a little bit about yourself, your background, where you're from, growing up, education.
Okay. I grew up in Delta Junction, which is 100 miles from Fairbanks. Probably not a subsistence community, but maybe now. I don't know. It certainly didn't seem to be. I graduated from high school there. I went to college in Santa Cruz. The first 2 years were at a community college, Cabrillo, and then got my undergraduate degree at UC Santa Cruz. I am not a Cooley person. My major was community studies. I never heard of Mr. Cooley, Dr. Cooley, whatever, until I came to Juneau and started meeting all these people. Then I went to law school at Berkeley, graduated from there in 1977, came back to Alaska to work for the Alaska Department of Law. My first couple of years, I worked in the human services section, which is a prescription for burning out. It's child in need of aid cases, mental commitments, alcohol commitments. And then I asked for the first transfer in the office that would come along. And it's really not fair because many people go to law school hoping to do natural resource law. I wasn't one of them. I just wanted to get back to Alaska. But the first opening that came along was in the natural resources section. And from there, my client agencies were Fish and Game, Natural Resources, some of the land use sections, Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, and DEC. And during the subsistence days that you guys are interested in, it was mostly Fish and Game was my client agency, although I had some work for those other agencies.
Could you clarify the year you started with natural resources at the Department of Law?
I believe it was late 1979.
Okay. So the state subsistence law had already been passed.
Right, though you'd never know it from the Department of Law's perspective.
Would you like to explain that?
Well, the reason I think it was 79 is I know I was working there by the spring of 1980, when Don Mitchell and Norman Cohen filed suit on behalf of the village of Tyonic, mm-hmm. because the Board of Fisheries had allowed sport fishing on the spring king salmon there, but hadn't allowed any Tyonic people. There was no subsistence fishery. So they filed a lawsuit, and this was the first time that the three lawyers, myself, John Gisberg, and Liza Fussner, as her last name was at that time, who represented the Department of Fish and Game, had our attention brought to the subsistence law. Nobody was talking about it. As soon as we looked at it, we looked at Norm and Don's papers, we pretty much settled, and the court did issue an order, but it was not because they won a great contested lawsuit. It was because we saw they were right, and that's when we, the lawyers that represented the boards, and advised the boards and the Department of Fish and Game, realized how nobody was doing anything under this law. And so as that year went along, we started telling the boards what they had to do under the law, which wasn't popular.
And what were if you can say the names again of those, your other lawyers, John?
John Gisberg, G-I-S-S, I think it's B. E-R-G, but it might be B-U-R-G. I'm sure it's in the papers. And Elizabeth, she wasn't married at that time. Her last name was Fussner, F-U-S-S-N-E-R. She primarily advised the game board, the board of game, and John primarily advised the fish board, but he was sort of the most senior of the three of us, so I came under him on the fish board side.
And Liza, you'll see her in many of the records as McCracken.
Right.
And then later on, she's Gay.
Right.
Is Liza Gay.
Is a last name Gay. Gay.
Right.
So you're saying, Larry, that the subsistence law went on the books, I think, on September 1st, 1978, And so the Department of Law really did nothing, no advice, no input, no review for almost a year and a half, not at all in 1979, right. And then until the board met regarding Tyonek sometime in early, it must have been February or March of 1980.
And it wasn't even then. It wasn't until Don and Norman filed the suit that we came to know of this situation.
So you were not at the board meeting itself? When...
Well, I wasn't. I don't know. John might have been there for part of it, but nobody was taught. None of our clients were saying, help, we need help with this. So there were lots of other things to do, and so it hadn't. But Don and Norman's complaint was pretty explicit when you went and looked at the statute. I mean, everyone talks about the subsistence priority, but it's actually two parts. It's the subsistence mandate. First, if there are subsistence uses, they have to be authorized. And then if there's any kind of cut shortage or that involves any kind of cutbacks, the other uses have to be cut back before subsistence does. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, nope, we knew nothing of it, but we learned fast after that.
So maybe Gisberg was sitting at the table when the Tyonek people came in. Yeah, because I didn't realize that Norm and Don had not actually been involved until after the Fish Board turned Tyonek down.
Okay.
That's the question.
Norm said yesterday that he was not at the board meeting itself, and that Fred Bismarck from Tyonek came to his office, but it sounds like that was after they were turned out and they came for help.
And so Don and Norman got involved at that point, and because of them getting involved, then we got alerted to it. But
the court did rule, right? I mean, you didn't just throw in the towel.
But it resulted in a court ruling. We confessed judgment or whatever. I don't know exactly what the phrase was, but there was a ruling from, it was Judge Carlson, that... yes, this is how it's supposed to work, and we agreed to all of it, and we did not argue about it. We didn't have a prayer. I mean, once we saw what the law said, there was no argument we could really make.
So you're in agreement that the Board of Fish met first, turned down Tyonek, and then they sued.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And thank you.
Did you ever get any feedback from board members or even department people after the court ruling regarding your role or position on it? Was there?
Well, that case was so clear. I mean, there was just nothing to argue about. But we didn't start. We started getting flack, I would say, when the board started meeting. John might have had interactions with the department. I was still. Like, I was the entry-level attorney in the fish and game triad at that point. So if Commissioner Skoog had been saying, what the heck is this? Or he would have said it to John, not me.
Okay.
So I was unaware of that. I don't know that it wasn't a problem. It didn't cause turmoil within the department. But when I learned of the not welcoming attitude, it was when we were in front of the board later. And so then we had to explain to the boards then what the law actually meant. And so if there were subsistence uses, you had to authorize them, and if you couldn't authorize everything, they had to have the priority, and they could only be eliminated if there was a sustained sustained yield issue for it.
And that was to the Fish Board, or was it the Joint Board that was told that?
I feel like that was the Fish Board, because the Cook Inlet stuff it was raised during the Tyonek case, but Cook Inlet was a morass of, and there were other lawsuits about subsistence, the Homer, there was a group from Homer and a group from Kenai, different lawsuits going on, so we had a lot of reason to update the board about things and how things worked and so forth. It was in, actually, so then the board in the, I assume it was December, because that's when it usually would have been the end of the 1980 year cycle board meeting in Anchorage, when the 10 criteria were initially, and they were 10 specific to Cook Inlet. Here is the board said how we will identify subsistence uses in Cook Inlet of salmon. It was very narrow. It wasn't like the joint board 8 criteria later. And there were some allegations that they were done in secret, and I do think they were drafted by a committee that was announced during the board, but the committee met off in a room in the Westward somewhere. Tom Bonner was involved in helping them come up with the criteria. And then in the spring meeting of some spring meeting, probably March, I would guess, I don't know, of 1981, the board basically readopted them, so it cured that Public Meetings Act violation, because that was part of an issue in a couple of the, not the Tyonic lawsuits, but in the Homer and Kenai lawsuits.
So you were not in the room when the 10 criteria were...
I was not, no. But one thing that Steve asked me earlier as we were getting ready for this is, was the subsistence division data not useful? And it was useful because that all those criteria came from the kind of things that subsistence division then even more later elaborated upon. And I can't remember where Tom Lawner got them, but he basically... The board wasn't going to come up with those 10 criteria on their own, so they came from him.
It was around that time that he wrote a paper that I'm pretty sure it might be subsistence as an economic system. It might be another one of those early papers, okay. And it has a graphic there that has various characteristics, and I think one side says subsistence and one side says sport or something like that, and I think he drew from that for picking the various things to look at, whether it's sharing or traditional passing on of knowledge or a wide variety of resources, local harvest efficiency, those kinds of things.
So he probably pulled those out of his head or from the paper when he was in the room. And in fairness, I mean, the board was not always a great entity, but I don't think they were trying to go behind the public's back. They were just trying to figure out what to do, so they went up to somebody's room so they'd be comfortable, and they had no problem readopting them the following spring on the record. And then I think they applied the criteria in that meeting, and it was found that a Tyonic, English Bay, and
Port Graham
were the only places that qualified under the 10 criteria.
Mm-hmm. So. And that led to the lawsuits, or the lawsuits were already happening?
That actually might have led to the lawsuits. Mm-hmm. Because up till then, I don't remember. I can't remember. They certainly got reinvigorated after they got applied to the communities and they didn't qualify.
So that was the spring of 81, 80?
I think in December of 1980 is when they applied them initially and identified those three communities, and then maybe they re-adopted as well as the 10 criteria in the spring of 81 to cure any issues.
So. Yeah, okay. All right. We can double-check the dates, I suspect. Yeah. I think Ken Roberson was actually involved in those criteria discussions too. I think
likely.
He told me that at one point. He was then he was working for Commercial Fisheries Division, but I know Lawner was the guy that, I think he did it on the back of an envelope.
Yes,
probably. Almost literally there.
Yeah, I have here in this timeline that it was 1980 that they developed the 10 criteria for Cook Inlet, but...
Yeah, well,
December 1980 would have been
right, because the Tyonic case was in May of 1980, and then we found out what it was. This is what. So, in order to do the first part, which was mandate that there be subsistence, that if there are subsistence uses, they have to be authorized. The board had to figure out how to decide if there were subsistence uses, because the words customary and traditional had not dropped out of anyone's lips that I know of in front of the board before then. So,
and were not defined in law.
And we're not.
So just to back up a second, you then played no role in the development of the 78 law.
I did not.
Yeah.
I didn't even know what happened.
Okay, you weren't
paying
attention.
I was busy doing child support.
Okay. right.
Well, and when you gave this presentation to the fisheries board about, okay, here's the subsistence law, and, you know, you guys have to implement it or whatever, what was the reception?
It was not wildly enthusiastic. On the other hand, because of what they did and had just those three villages be eligible for subsistence in Cook Inlet, there wasn't a lot of spin-off effects on other intersecting use groups. You know, the commercial fisheries, the sport fisheries, these were fairly limited spots. I think the outrage grew as it became apparent this wasn't just going to be in those places in Cook Inlet. Mm-hmm. It was going to be a bigger deal.
And when did that start happening, that it was becoming a bigger deal?
Well, let's see. The joint board, I have to back up, I think. The joint board adopted the eight criteria in 82, I think. Unless, actually, I could look in that brief over there and see. Actually, I will.
Hold on.
I'm not sure I have it in my timeline here.
And it got distilled out of the
out of the ten,
yeah,
right,
criteria. Okay, new category fishing. In the spring of 1982, the board, together with the Board of Fisheries, together with the Board of Game, jointly adopted the eight criteria, basically.
Okay.
Things were happening, starting to happen. Once there was, it seemed like lawyers learned about the law, too, because more cases started happening, and Cook Inlet was one of the main hotbed places, but I would say there was the animosity toward being told that this is how they had to proceed. It might have been incipient in 1980, but I don't think anyone actually realized the magnitude of what this was going to mean, because it was only those three villages, and nobody was thinking bigger. The joint board would have adopted that in the spring of 82, because we were trying to come into compliance with ANILCA, and they have an acknowledgement in the eight criteria that it identifies customary and traditional uses by rural Alaska residents. So they stuck it in there because we were going to make the case to the Department of Interior that even though our statute didn't say rural, it meant rural, and here's how we were going to mm-hmm. proceed. And certainly by then there was plenty of animosity, because there was a petition the initiative to repeal the subsistence law was starting to circulate, and there was a fair amount of animosity. And they didn't like the Department of Law telling them this, but if there's a discretionary action that the board does, then the Department of Law has just makes sure that the boards follow the rules and make sure they don't violate the Public Meetings Act, which we didn't do that one time. And that they talk about on the record what the reason is for what they're doing. But when the law takes away their discretion, then the Department of Law has to tell them that, and they didn't like that at all. I was much more forthright than John Gisberg, so I think that I got more of the animosity than he did. He was a good lawyer, but he was not. His modus operandi had always been to try to work with his clients. And this was not working with the clients. This was making the clients do something they didn't want to do. I forgot what the question was. I think I've been rambling.
Well, it was how it was received the board.
Not well.
Mm-hmm.
And those eight criteria that were adopted in 82, who drafted those?
They were like a distillation and a condensation of the 10 criteria. and I can't remember who the committee was or how it came to be. I don't know. I don't even know if it was a department proposal.
It could have been. It could have been Denny Kelso.
Yeah. It could have been. Because the department at that point was also officially trying to come into compliance with ANILCA, because we didn't want to lose, state didn't want to lose management. So for all I know, because I don't remember, it was a department proposal to the joint board. Here are your ten criteria turned into 8. I don't know if that happened, but it seems likely to me it did, because it seems like an awkward, elaborate format to come up with in a board meeting.
Right.
And especially with everybody, many people thinking about how can we make our law fit the federal law. I feel like it must have been done ahead of time, but I mean, I don't mean a secret deal. I mean,
right.
put forth to them in some fashion.
I'm pretty sure that is correct. Yeah,
okay.
And there might have even been like a draft of it reviewed in an earlier joint board meeting in late 81.
That could be right.
And then was redone in 82, as I recall.
That's absolutely.
I stumbled
possible.
Upon some.
So this time period, there was a joint board of fisheries and game. It was just the one board? Or?
No. The game board met to handle game issues.
Right.
And the fish board met to handle fish issues. But when there were issues that bridged both categories, like this did,
mm-hmm.
Then they met as a joint board. So they met
okay.
together.
So that only happened periodically.
Right.
Okay.
In fact, I'm sure it must have happened for other reasons. I think, for example, the boards have to recommend some names if there's a vacancy for the Department of Fish and Game Commissioner, so they probably meet jointly to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't. All my memories of the joint board have to do with subsistence
right.
stuff.
The other major category that they deal with is advisory committee regulations,
right.
and actually they create the advisory committees. The
right.
joint board does that. So if there's any change to how they are supposed to operate or who they are, or if there's specific memberships, the joint board has to do that. But when I first started, the joint board was meeting quite a bit, mostly to deal with the subsistence
right.
things. But they can go years now
without a
joint
right.
board.
Right.
I'm pretty sure just jumping ahead a little bit, but after the 86 subsistence law, it must have been the joint board that met to decide what were rural areas.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So then, after the Tayona case, and you presenting to the board is, okay, now you guys have to do something. There's a subsistence law. What were the other things, next things you were working on?
Regarding implementation of the law.
Right,
yeah.
right. Well, the Madison and Josen cases were moving along and eventually were consolidated. So there were, and that was mostly me. Now John sort of turned over subsistence and quickly to me, which was very kind of him. There was lots of, well, I wasn't really directly involved in it. There was a lot going on because of the initiative to repeal the subsistence law. There were a fair number of cases about subsistence, but I can't remember which cases happened when. I'm sure there was a Nilchina case, but Liza handled that because she handled the game stuff more.
Yeah, that's the Ewan case.
The
Ewan case,
yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The two Superior Court cases in Cook Inlet, Madison was, we won, ruled by Judge Carlson, and I forgot who the judge was in the Josen case, and I forgot whether we won or not, because they were consolidated under the name of Madison and appealed, and then eventually that caused some havoc
mm-hmm.
with everybody. But it was around this time that I mentioned yesterday, I was so astounded to discover, because I'd always been liked, I thought, people generally like me. I'm nice, but one of the fish board members, at least one of them, was trying to fire me and was trying to get me fired. And I was so taken aback. And then I thought, okay, well, that's fine. But
and so, what was his argument? That did you know what? And
I only learned about it from John, who told me that this was happening and that it wasn't going to happen, but that there was pressure. to have me fired or at least taken off as an agency attorney. I don't know what, I know what the real reason probably was, which was he didn't like that I was telling them they had to do it this way, that I was too affirmative about that. But it's kind of hard to think he could have used that as, he tends to have a pretext, but I don't know what the pretext was.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't, at least not then.
Yeah.
So.
One thing I wanted to ask you about in those mm-hmm. early days, because the board not only identified those three communities as the only ones eligible, but it also limited participation in those fisheries to those to residents of those three
right.
places. Was the Department of Law advice that the Fish Board had to do that at that, because we weren't a tier two or anything?
No, I think that actually came out of the 10 criteria, and the idea of the 10 criteria was, it even mentions the word community, sharing, taking mm-hmm. and sharing within a community.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it just naturally followed from the 10 criteria wouldn't identify just places where there were subsistence uses. It would identify areas where the people in that area were participating in customary mm-hmm. and traditional uses, or mm-hmm. whatever the exact term was. And so somebody from Anchorage wasn't in that area, even
yeah.
if there was, and the law wasn't perfect, and everybody knew there might be a native family in Anchorage who couldn't go, and
yeah.
there might be the proverbial dentist in Bethel who could go,
mm-hmm.
But generally the law doesn't have to be perfect, so
mm-hmm.
that was not a problem for the Department of Law.
Yeah.
And so we were fine with the 10 criteria and going forward, and we just wanted to make sure that they made findings on the record about the 10 criteria and why they thought someplace did mm-hmm. or didn't fit.
Did you make any, did you provide any advice to the board about the role of the subsistence section or the subsistence division?
I can't remember the issues, but I do remember at various points saying, Mr. Chairman,
yeah,
it always was
hand.
A mister. I guess yeah. Brenda wasn't a mister.
No,
the Subsistence Division has provided information about X, Y, and Z, and therefore you have to account for that in your findings about whatever you're going to do. It's sort of drawing attention to those, and so it kind of put the board, either they couldn't just pretend they hadn't heard it.
They couldn't ignore it.
Explain it away somehow or bow to it if it seemed to require a certain result. So I remember at least a good handful of times of saying, well, you've heard X, Y, and Z, and so that you need to talk about that under the 8 criteria or the 10 criteria. And the board really wasn't used to explaining why they were doing what they were doing. It wasn't a thing they were much into. So that was another a side irritant to the fact that they had to do this at all, and then they had to explain why and how it fit the facts that were being put before them. So in that sense, I mean, I don't think I spoke to the because it could have been from advisory committees too,
mm-hmm.
but off as well as the subsistence division.
Yeah.
So they had to, if they heard this information and they made a decision counter to what they had heard, they had to explain why.
Right.
Sort of like, you know, court with evidence and, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And that's just for anything. I mean, if there were allocation issues between different commercial use groups and they made a decision, we would always encourage them to explain why they came to that decision, because for that, it's not a mandate kind of thing, but a court would look at whether what they did was reasonable. And so they have to have something about why they did what they did.
Right, you have to have it on the record.
Right. I can't remember the details, but the Bobby case, which was a game case, the board did something and didn't explain it at all. And so they did, the Bobby plaintiffs did pretty well of the case, at least to begin with. Again, it was a game case, so it was mostly Liza. But if I think the board started to learn that by the, if they didn't explain why they were doing and how it fit what they had heard, they were in trouble.
Yeah, I'd have to double check on that too, but I think part of it, it might have been having to do with seasons or something like that, that the Lyme Village people wanted a longer season.
Yes.
And the game board said no and didn't really explain for management or sustained yield or anything.
Right.
It had to be like that, and the court said that just sounds arbitrary.
That
to
seems
us.
Right to
if
me.
It's traditional that they took caribou in April and there's no biological reason
not
that they
to.
Can't
yeah.
you can't stop them from doing that.
Right.
Yeah.
That's Bobby case. That was Lyme Village.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. The Bobbies are a Lyme Village family.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oops. All right, wait a second, Bill. We can't hear you.
Start over.
All the static on the line, I have you turned down. Go ahead.
Start over, please.
Okay, could we go back to the Madison case? It was mentioned a few minutes ago, and I want to make sure that we understand your involvement in that and how that fits into this bigger progression. We talked about the Tyonek situation. Now let's talk about the Madison.
So the Madison case challenged the 10 criteria, and the state prevailed. Just 1 second, I'll tell you if we won Josend or not.
And how do you say to spell that other one?
Josund. It's not famous because by the time it reached the Supreme Court, it was Madison and Josend, and nobody ever says Josend.
Right.
Yeah. Just like Katie John.
Steve was going to say Josend. Oh, so in Josend, the 10 criteria were also upheld. So, mm-hmm. So in Madison and in Josend, two different Superior Court judges upheld the 10 criteria. I think there was some other side notes about other stuff in Josend. So then we told the board, well, we're fine, good to go, proceed ahead. And that was in 82. So we also presumed that the 8 criteria would be fine because mm-hmm. of a similar thing. And then, of course, when the court ruled in 85...
This is the Supreme Court. Now.
This is then it went to the Supreme Court, and they weren't having it. So
the Madison case, the state was sued because
why? The Madison case was people in the Kenai who thought they should be able to subsistence fish, and the Josend case because of people in Homer who thought they should subsistence fish,
okay.
And at that point the first year of that, there was no personal use fishery, and that was made it even worse. But then by the next summer, the board had established a personal use fishery category in regulation, so there was a personal use fishery at least at that point. And then later, the legislature put it into statute. But so then from 82 till when was Madison decided?
It's 85.
Probably
85. Yeah.
Okay. So we were considered ourselves good to go on the 10 criteria and compliance with ANILCA. But Madison, combined with this Josend case, was working its way to the Alaska Supreme Court. And the argument there was, I don't know, am I jumping ahead?
No.
Okay.
No.
That the statute, the state statute, did not authorize this approach. And there was lots of legislative history. It's really another situation where the Subsistence Division couldn't have done anything better. They could have helped the result because there was a lot of legislative history that seemed to me, and says in the brief, as to why that supports this community approach and why that's fine. But the Supreme Court found there's, I'm sure the other lawyers, I don't have their briefs, cited other legislative history, and it was unanimous. That case was unanimous. Mm. All five justices found that the state statute, as it existed, did not authorize this community approach to subsistence, and that one of the reasons one of the subsidiary reasons for finding that was the Tier 2 criteria, which did allow an individual approach. So they said it didn't make sense that tier one, if you want to call it that, that the first cut would be limited to less than all Alaskans because there was nothing in the statute that said anything about doing that. So then all hell broke loose. So that was a statutory thing that could be fixed by the legislature. However, it led to, I think, with Steve, I think you mentioned, or maybe the 1985 Emergency Game Board meeting, which was, oh God, it was so grueling and it was horrible. It took place down here. And because hunts were worse than for fishing, and if all Alaskans were subsistence users for all hunts, then almost all hunts, numerous hunts, had to go to Tier 2. And so we painstakingly sat in that conference room at Fish and Game and just with a game board and went through all these hunts, and they got converted to Tier 2. And the board, somehow there was the implication, not out loud, but maybe from Bob Hinman-ish kinds of people, and maybe Somerville wasn't in the department anymore, of course, that we were being extreme because we wanted to turn it into a crisis so that the legislature would do something. But we really weren't. That's what it seemed to follow, the logic that seemed to follow, although it did help. I mean, it was a dreadful result and just horrible morass of paperwork. And the game division, or maybe they were wildlife conservation by then, they were in there and they were providing information, and subsistence division was there providing information, and everybody was trying to come up with stuff. And you wouldn't have been there because it was game.
I should have been there, but I was in Great Britain.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Clever man.
Yeah.
So it was a mess. And so the legislature started...
I forgot to say, turn off your cell phone.
So Megan's heading for the boat. Are you heading for
I'm
the
heading
boat?
I'm heading for the boat, so I need medicine.
Right.
Okay, right. So we're back.
But we're close to the end. Yeah. But the response then by the administration was that we've got to fix this.
Right.
We can't live with this. And so a new law was developed then, and you must have played a role in that.
Yes, and let's see, who was governor? It was a good governor, right? Was that Knowles?
That was either Cooper or Sheffield in
86.
It was still Sheffield.
Cooper. Really? Still?
It was still Sheffield,
because okay,
Cooper
Sheffield.
Came in, I think, in 80. Was elected in late 86.
Right, that's right. That's right. And then Denny was deputy commissioner still.
Yes.
And he
right.
hadn't gone over to DEC yet. The subsistence division data was very important to the new law, but I don't think the subsistence division had much to do with it, because Denny was like heading the effort for the Steve sometimes would show up in my office and as well with Denny, and Jim Ayers was Jim Ayers. Jim Ayers must have been Cooper's chief of staff, and Jim Ayers was part of drafting stuff. And then and Don Mitchell was there for AFN. He was still in AFN, and different versions and iterations were talked about. And but the subsistence division data was really key to that, because the statute has a lot about how rural areas are supposed to be identified, and that's I don't know if it was word for word from the subsistence division, but it's certainly subsistence division-y kind of stuff, not just something some lawyer wrote up somewhere. And it was great data. And just like with Madison, the Alaska Supreme Court, going back to Madison, didn't throw out the 10 criteria because they disagreed with anything about the data. They disagreed about the history of the statute and what the statute meant. It was just a pure legal analysis based on the legislative history, and it just obviously meant educational. It obviously meant non-community. It meant everybody
individual.
Until you got to Tier 2. Individual. Thank you. That was the word I was looking
individual.
For. It started with a vowel.
Right. But so basically they're saying it wasn't in the 78 law specifically, so therefore you couldn't.
Well, and not only was it not only in the law specifically, but then the department interpreted it, the boards interpreted it a certain way, and that interpretation wasn't supported by any of the at least the legislative history they chose. It was right. supported by some legislative history, right. but not what they chose to pay attention to. But it was not a problem with the subsistence division data at all. Similarly, so now we're in 1986, so then we passed the statute, and the Department of Interior has held off taking over management to give us time to fix our situation, and they have certified that it was fixed, and we still in control, the later when the 1986 law is thrown out in McDowell, it again has nothing to do with the subsistence division data. The subsistence division data wasn't questioned. It was just four of the five justices thought it couldn't operate that way under the Constitution. The fifth justice, who dissented, understood it all and said it was perfectly fine, and he should have. And he's the best justice in my opinion.
That's Rabinowitz.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's the one that Denny clerked for when he first came from law school. So, in answer to Steve's question, before you guys ever got here, to me, the subsistence division data. Oh, and the Kanaitse case, which we haven't even got to yet. Right. The data, nothing was wrong with the data. What was wrong was the lenses that the court was using to look at the situation. So
it's how it was being applied, how the laws and regulations were being applied.
Well, it was first Madison. The court said, no, the statute doesn't mean that less than all Alaskans are subsistence users at first blush. And then when you get to McDowell, the court says, no, the Constitution won't let you pick among. So it was nothing to do with the way they were applying it. I mean, even if we hadn't even applied at all, it still would have said residents of rural areas. And those four justices said, no, you can't do that under the equal access provisions of the Alaska Constitution. And then the Kanaitse case, which I don't want to jump to, but there it was the Ninth Circuit. And the Ninth Circuit, no, I shouldn't get onto Kanaitse yet. I'm sorry. I'll say that. Do that in the process.
Let's wait on it. But
it wasn't the subsistence division's fault there.
Well, you think it's true that there hasn't been any case in front of a state or federal court where the judgment revolved around deficiencies in what the division provided?
Not one case. No. And usually, actually, when you say federal court, we always, at least almost always, won at the district court, at the lower federal court. Like the Superior Court is the lower level in the Alaska courts, and we won both of those big cases, McDowell and Madison, at the Superior Court level, and lost them at the Supreme Court level. And the almost every federal court case, the district court case, we won. And it was deferring to reasonable interpretation and good data and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And the big case that I was involved in that we lost was the Kanaitse, and nothing to do with subsistence data. So I think, in fact, usually, unless it was one of those cases like Bobby, I guess Bobby we lost, but it was because of the seasons that the board didn't. It wasn't subsistence division data. It was, in fact, that what the board did wasn't consistent with subsistence division data. So I guess you could say that, but it wasn't the subsistence division's fault. It was the board's fault.
But in all these cases, the subsistence division data was used on one side or the other to prove the case?
Well, for example, in Bobby, which is the one that Jim remembered more of the details than I did, which was where they gave a limited season, a hunting season. This is the Lyme Village case. But the data showed that they hunted a lot more widely than that, and there was no conservation reason or any other reason to make it this limited season. So the subsistence division data shot the game board in the foot, because there in the record it says, you know, they had all this use, and the game board, without saying any reason why, didn't let them do it. So the division data... I'm not saying it didn't crop up in cases where the state lost, but only in cases where the state should have lost because the board did the wrong thing.
Yeah. As I recall, in the Kenaitse case, they might actually name me by name and say something to the effect that the information that we provided was, you know, was fine, but in their view was not needed because the rural, because what rural is just so obvious
exactly.
to everybody.
So maddening. Yeah. Yeah. Yep, yeah. That's right. I didn't remember you by name, but what they said.
I know I showed up in one of those cases. Well,
that's because of your famous ancestors.
That's exactly right. We won't go into that.
No, not on the record anyway.
But another issue that I think you were with the Fish Board when they dealt with this, and that we provided a lot of information for, was the Copper River, and what the Board of Fisheries was tasked to do. And I'm pretty sure this is post repeal initiative failure, was to decide where the customary and traditional uses of upper Copper River salmon were occurring, and specifically whether the dipnet fishery at Chitna, which was largely
Fairbanks, right?
Fairbanks yeah. people going down there, would pass the C&T test, and whether it should be a subsistence fishery or a personal use fishery. And the division, provided a lot of information.
Right.
Were you sitting at the table?
My guess, I don't remember any lawsuit that arose from that, but they decided on personal use, right?
They did.
Ultimately, the Katie John case was from the Copper River, but I don't think it was about this, was it?
No, okay. that was a different okay. a different issue. I think actually there was a court case where the court reviewed the Board of Fisheries
okay.
decision on, but they did it several times. I think that's, and it could be that the early decision was not challenged, and then under the new law was, and maybe you were gone by then.
I was gone by
but
then.
I'm pretty sure what the court said in upholding the board's finding was that it was a close call, that they looked at how the board had debated it,
mm-hmm.
and they thought it could have gone either way, but you know they deferred to the
right.
to the
right.
to the Board of Fisheries judgment and where they went and yeah.
because if it is a close call, that is what they're supposed to do.
Were you there for Katie John when she originally came before the Fish Board?
Liza did that case, actually. And so I assisted her. I mean, I consulted with her, but she handled it way more than I did.
And you had mentioned here in the timeline that first began in 1985, Katie John first came before the board.
The way I found that out was because I couldn't. Where it showed up on the timeline, it seemed
right.
like it was way too late. And I looked it up, and I think it's NARF. Somebody has a chronology of the Katie John
right.
situation, and that's where I got the 1985.
Okay.
I have no independent memory of that. But
okay.
but it went on a long time
right.
in various
right.
iterations.
But she came before the Fish Board.
She came before the Fish Board because the. It's interesting that it's 85 because I thought maybe it's before Madison ruled because the state was in compliance with federal law.
At that point.
Because really had to do with what was required under federal law that the state was implementing. And what Katie John wanted to do was open up her traditional fishing site at Batsonitas,
right.
Which is above the upper bounds of what the state was allowing where the state was allowing the subsistence fishery to occur. And so Kate, and this is another example where Katie is named first, and there's two other
right,
people
but nobody
there,
knows
but nobody
about
even
them.
Knows who they are. One is Doris Charles, and I don't remember who the third person was, but at least Katie and Doris Charles were both at that meeting, which is in Fairbanks, as I recall.
So and maybe yeah. NARF's, I only got the 85
uh-huh.
from NARF's,
yeah,
I think it was NARF, somebody's
yeah.
article, a summary
yeah.
of the whole Katie John case.
Right.
So that might not be right, actually.
Yeah.
And you're right, because with Madison, well, although the feds held off.
They
on
did.
Madison's. So yeah. It might have been in there, but the feds were holding off, so we just proceeded anyway.
It could
because
be.
They were giving us, I forgot how long, they gave us X amount of time to get ourselves back into compliance. So.
And what the Fish Board said, you know, Katie John was saying, well, this is my traditional area, and I think we did this, but if we didn't do it, Jim Carrey from the Alaska Native Language Center testified and said, well, you know, the Otnas, they have traditional territories, and people, in their view, just can't go anywhere along the river to fish. They might ask permission to be allowed to, because Katie, after that area was closed, she had gone down all the way to Chitna, but that wasn't her traditional territory. Right. It was at Batsilias, and then the fish are different and all these other kinds of things. So that was put on the record, I think, by us, but certainly by others, including Katie, I think, herself. But the Fish Board said, well, we don't really have to pay attention to that. Part of it was that Comfish said, you know, if you allow subsistence fisheries that far upriver, we're going to have to shut down the commercial fishery. The whole thing's going to go to hell. And we don't want people fishing that far upstream. We want people further down.
So in 85, I was living in Juneau by then. And so the Fish Board probably was meeting in Anchorage.
I think they were in Fairbanks.
In Fairbanks, okay. So it may be that, I'm reconstructing this, it may be that Liza was handling the lawsuit because maybe
she
went to that
there.
Board meeting.
Yeah.
I'm not leaving, I'm just getting some water. So
I'm just going to pause a second then. Gone. Okay. Maybe we should talk about the Kenite Sea case because that.
Yeah, let's do that.
Applies more than the Katie John.
To our time, to our time zone.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Our time frame.
And since you were the lead, perhaps, on the Kenite Sea case?
Yeah. There's another one where we won. That was a federal case. We won at the federal district court level. So this was the Kenite Seas saying. The Kenai was rural and they had subsistence uses, and this was the state was doing it all wrong. So, and they sued in federal court, which is interesting because the state could not be made to comply with ANILCA. So it was a little bit weird thing anyway, because what was the court going to do? The court, I guess, could declare that it wasn't. I mean. The court could not order the state to comply with ANILCA. The state had to operate under its own rules. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the gist of the Kenite Sea argument was they had a whole slew of arguments, but they were a rural area. They were customary and traditional users. They should get to subsistence fish. That was what they cared about. So the Ninth Circuit didn't denigrate the subsistence division data. Subsistence division data turns out to be irrelevant. So the Ninth Circuit ruled against the state and said the state's approach to rural is not consistent with ANILCA. And that was in 89, early 80. It was well before Madison. I mean, well before McDowell.
Yeah.
So
88, I think, is when they originally sued.
And yeah.
88 is when they originally sued. And then you say that you won in...
We won at the lower court.
Okay.
So we must have lost the appeal in the middle of 88 because I was filing for rehearing in November of 88. And what the court said was, yes, there's a lot of legislative history, and yes, there's a lot of implementation history, but courts do not look at that if the language of the statute is clear. And the meaning of rural is clear. And then they proceeded to give examples of the clear meaning of rural that were inconsistent with each other and also had nothing to do with Alaska. One of it was wide open spaces. Well, that's much of Alaska, you know. One of them was places where agriculture and ranching are common, rural, which would be the Mat-Su Valley. Maybe Delta Junction. Now, but maybe not then. One of them was Census Bureau, some things that meant that really every place except Anchorage would be rural. So the examples they gave were inconsistent with each other and also bore no relationship to fishing and hunting. But so they said, no, so we don't look at any of this other stuff. And Don Mitchell used to say that he figured while they were up in Alaska for the oral argument, they must have driven down to the Kenai and looked around and said, well, there's nothing here. It must be rural. I mean, that was how stupid their ruling was, but they didn't agree, and they didn't, and they are the court. And we did, I think we petitioned the Supreme Court, but if we did, we didn't win. I mean, they didn't take the case. So, so what that meant was, there we have a ruling that the rural approach of the state was inconsistent with ANILCA, but no real guidance as to which of these many plain meanings of rural should be used. And I'm kind of stumped remembering, I'll use the word hiatus, the hiatus between Kanaitse and McDowell, because McDowell happened the following December, I think. It was 89 anyway, the end of 89. And what were we doing about rural in the meantime? Maybe the petition for rehearing was sitting there.
I think that's what it was. I think that it hadn't actually been fully dealt with at the federal level. And then we fell out of compliance with ANILCA, and so it became moot.
In moot, that's right. Yeah. Then it didn't matter.
And,
so,
and the feds had to come up with their own.
So if we hadn't had the unconstitutional ruling in McDowell, we would have had to grapple with Kanaitse, and what did that mean? And it just meant, you know, it meant made no sense. And but again, nothing to do with subsistence division data. They just refused to look beyond the word rural. So yeah. So the subsistence division comes through flying colors everywhere, as far as I can see.
But so Kanaitse, they sued in federal court.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Why not in state court?
Because they were claiming it was inconsistent with ANILCA.
Oh, okay.
And the state was in
out of compliance with ANILCA.
Well, the state was in compliance.
Well, we were in compliance, but they said the definition of rural that we were using was inconsistent.
Yeah.
So you'd think that the relief they would have requested would have been for the Department of Interior to take over, but that wasn't exactly what they wanted to fish. You know, they weren't totally logical.
They
in
wanted
constructing
to fish under, and what they qualified as subsistence.
Yeah, and they wanted to fish in the lower portion of the river, which is not within the refuge. Yeah, and of course the sad thing about this is that to this day most Kanaitse are not eligible to participate under federal rules, because the feds did indeed go in there and carve out some non-rural places based largely upon population size.
Right.
And that's where the majority of the Kanaitse tribal members still live.
Right, but then they also set up a temporary educational subsistence fishery.
That was just for the first year, because we needed to do something because of the case. Maybe that was going to hold, be like a placeholder until the court finished.
No, that still exists, though.
The educational fishery
became a standard thing that the Kanaitse got. And that, you know whose idea that was? Steve's. It was Steve Behnke.
My Steve?
Yes.
Wow, good
Yes,
God.
Indeed. That they were trying to figure out some way, because everybody, you know, fell for the Kanaitse tribe. Nobody disputes that they are the indigenous people of the Kenai River.
Right.
And they have a long history there. It's just a lot of other people have moved in, and the concern is that everybody else is eligible if they're eligible, and that's really not what they want either.
Right.
Yeah, but Steve was actually said, well, maybe we can create some kind of educational fishery that they can apply for, and that's indeed what happened. And they still get that permit, as far as I know. At one point, and they have to apply every year and so forth. The rules might have changed since I stopped paying attention to it. But Mary Pete and I went down to and met with the Kanaitse board some years. This is way back now. And we were trying to figure out a way that they wouldn't have to
do it every year.
Could we actually get a regulation, perhaps, that established the education? And it never went anywhere. I wish we had pushed a little bit harder, but I think that was towards the end of the time when Mary was director and other things happened. The opportunity closed.
Another maddening thing about the Ninth Circuit was not only did they say, oh, it's obvious, and then they give these inconsistent things, but they seem to have been under the impression that before the state enacted the 86th law, the Kanaitse's could subsistence fish, and that we took it away somehow with the 86th law and the ruling that it wasn't formally a rural area. And and there was no formal rulings about rural areas under the 8 criteria. It was just in part of the whole thing. But what are you going to do? They're the judges. I mean, it's mm-hmm. just, there was nothing left to be done. And then you're right, it went away with McDowell because that put
the... So you're saying the Kenaitse were able to fish before the...
They weren't. They were all wrong about that.
Okay, they didn't fit the 8 criteria.
No, and maybe at one point, maybe all fishing with nets for personal use was subsistence. But
yeah, I think before the late 70s, they could put out a net.
But the Ninth Circuit seemed to think that before the 86 law, they could subsistence fish, and they couldn't.
Well, then this gets us up to McDowell, right? The next big legal issue.
Well, it was, again, just 4 of the 5 justices. I wonder why. There was so much... I just reread my brief, so of course I've been persuaded that it was so obvious. Why couldn't they all go with a Rabinowitz? But they took very limited and limiting views of the provisions of the Constitution that basically touch on equal access or access. And one of the big things that they focused on for equal protection. Because there is an equal protection section in the natural resources provisions of the Alaska Constitution beside the general everybody gets equal protection one. If it's not a fundamental right or a very important right, if it's just a regular everyday right, then you don't have to have perfection in the classes. And thus the dentist in Bethel or the unfortunate native family that lives in Anchorage, they just... part of the collateral damage, but you don't have to be that precise. And Rabinowitz went with that. But they somehow, it's not entirely clear how they found it to be a stronger right and that it wasn't, the means were too coarse to achieve the ends. And they thought that an individual approach would be a much better way to go, and they didn't say it had to be that way, and they didn't guarantee it would pass constitutional muster, but this was too coarse, too rough. It had to be more precise.
And what were the implications now within the Department of Law and the boards that you were working with?
Well, God, I think we got to stay for a little while, maybe to get us through the summer, because it happened in December. I think they gave us a long stay. And there was no... you can't appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court from a state Supreme Court decision about a state constitution and a state statute. There's no recourse there. So the governor, whoever was governor, it must have been Cooper by then, I suppose, tried to get the legislature to do an amendment. The only thing was a constitutional amendment could have fixed it. And we drafted I was involved in drafting the constitutional amendment. It didn't pass. So I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was something like for the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. I mean, they had to do a constitutional amendment to limit entry into commercial fisheries. It was sort of like that, except not to do it on an individual basis, just to limit participation. Well, I think we were working with the Department of Interior people to sort of, and we certainly were in the 86 law to make sure that the law we passed was going to be consistent with ANILCA, and we were keeping them up to date with where we were. And again, they gave us some time to try to, and the statewide polling showed because to get a constitutional amendment, you have to pass it through both houses of the legislature, and then it has to go on a ballot. Mm-hmm. And it showed that if it ever got to the ballot, we would have it would have overwhelmingly prevailed, but we couldn't get it out. We got it in the Senate, and we couldn't get it out of the House, I think is the way, and we couldn't anyway. It never did get out of the legislature, and it. I think it was tried even afterwards, even after we formally lost management. So, Yeah. And so that trying to get the constitutional amendment must have been, a lot happened in the 1990 legislative session because the case was in 89.
Right.
And somewhere in there, Heckel got elected, right?
91.
Oh, he got elected in 90.
But he started his term in 91, okay. I think.
It might have been December.
Well, December. 90, okay.
Yeah.
Because then, with Heckel, Somerville was back in power. Was he commissioner? Surely not.
They tried to get him as commissioner, but the joint board would not pass his name on. So he became what was called, I think he was a special advisor or something.
Well, he was back in the mix.
Yeah.
And I got transferred from the natural resources section, where I'd been since 1979, we think, to the commercial section in the Department of Law. I didn't get fired, but I was sent off to do insurance law. So I wasn't involved in any more. But little did they know, I was pregnant. So I think they thought maybe I would resign, but I stuck it out so I could have the birth covered and maternity leave.
But that was done, you think, at least specifically at the suggestion of Somerville to get you out of the picture?
I don't know if it was Somervillian of thing, because I was a bad guy in his view, and others of his ilk. Ilk sounds bad, but others that shared his worldview.
Yeah.
So somebody in that group.
And I don't remember her name, but I recall that the person that was then assigned by the Heckel administration to solve the problem was the attorney for McDowell.
Oh, Sheree Jacobus.
That's right.
Sheree Jacobus, my.
So to talk about an irony or...
Yeah,
or,
that's right. I forgot all about that.
Punch in the nose.
That's right. And so did she come to work for the Department of Law?
Yeah, I think so.
That's
or
right.
Maybe she was like an advisor within the governor's office. But she then became... And I remember being involved in meetings and teleconferences about what to do, and everybody was deferring to her.
Yeah.
You know, and she's the one that's... actually, I'd say she's the one that caused it. I heard I don't know whether this is true or not, that the filings in the McDowell case were really on the part of the proponents were really not very great. They were weak in a lot of ways, and that the justices themselves developed asked some of their staff to actually look into it some more. This might be correct, but boy, this attorney has done a pretty lousy job. So we better look into it a little bit more. And then she shows up as the person that's going to get us a new subsistence law.
Well, I forgot about that, but that's right. I didn't actually, and I have to say, I think Heckel's attorney general was Charlie Cole.
Yes.
That's correct.
Who was a very nice, humane, decent man, and it could have been, I speculated at the time, that maybe whoever it was trying to get me fired, but instead he shifted me to the commercial section to not to fire me and leave me the choice of leaving if I didn't want to be in the commercial section, which I didn't, but
so did you leave the Department of Law pretty soon after that?
Megan was born in 1972, November. Definitely not 1972. That was a young mother.
Right. 1992.
So I left after November 1992, after my maternity leave ran out. So I never went back to work after she was born. But by the time I got moved over, we were aiming to be pregnant, and it turned out, and all was well. So anyway, I wasn't in the room, as we say sometimes in this discussion group, for anything else.
Was the Department of Law involved in the Tier 2 criteria in developing those, or that was all, and the boards, were they developing those?
Well, you mean before the law went out the window back in the day?
Because
then there were some other Tier 2.
Well, right? After McDowell, wasn't that when you did the Tier 2? Because you had to decide who qualified.
First after Madison. Madison, when the statute meant all Alaskans were eligible. So if the hunt or a fishery couldn't handle all Alaskans, then they had to, which Alaskans had to be picked by the three criteria. And then after my time, one of the three criteria was thrown out, right? The location?
That was post, it was post McDowell, and it was kind of predictable. We couldn't keep the second of the three, right, the right. local residents.
I guess in 85, yeah, there was a first tier two system, and then in 90 post McDowell there was a second one.
Yeah,
and I didn't know who developed that, if the Department of Law had anything to do with it.
In the statute had the three main criteria as to what was supposed to be used to distinguish among people. Right. And I was certainly at the game board meeting while they were figuring out how to, the emergency game board meeting after Madison, after it thrown out on statutory reasons, how to apply those criteria.
Yeah, you had to operationalize them and put some ought to measure them so that each person could be scored.
Right, yeah. But I don't think the Department of Law, other than I was there in case something terrible happened.
Yeah, well, the Division of Subsistence drafted the
those criteria.
Yeah, and probably Wildlife Division was part of that, too.
Right. I just didn't know if the Department of Law got involved in that kind of
thing. Well, I know that it was run by them, you know.
It was, but we didn't come up with them in any way.
No, they didn't draft it. And they've been modified since then several times. It took up a lot of my work.
Right.
A lot of it. Never fun.
No. I'm looking at Jim for. I guess this is a question about, you know, you were at all these fish board meetings and maybe some game board meetings, and subsistence staff were there in some cases presenting. Did you get a sense of how the board members were interacting with subsistence staff and how that all went?
What did you observe?
It changed over time. Oh. I mean, at the beginning, before they realized what was going on, but once they realized what was going to be happening, there was not much friendship toward the not very amicable from the board members toward the, but then the governor changed and some of the board members changed. And by the time we were at the emergency game board meeting, or even before then, when the game board was trying to fix Lyme Village and get the Bobby case and get better regs and have findings about it and stuff, the board members, many of them, were looking to the Division of Subsistence to how to figure this out, how to word this. So over time, while I was part of it, the board members actually changed, not in the sense of changing their attitudes. They were different board members. So you had Brenda Johnson and
Sarah Scanlon.
And then Vic Van Ballenberg, who was kind of a scientist-y guy, but he wasn't against the subsistence division. And so then I think everybody thought the subsistence division were lifesavers because they could help figure out how to approach things and stuff. But in the bad old board, as one might say, didn't really like them that much, I don't think. So,
and were they outwardly antagonistic during presentations, or
I don't remember any overt hostility, but I might not have picked up on it.
There's one that I remember, and I think you were in the room, and the with the Board of Fisheries, Nick Szabo was the chair, and they were debating a proposal having to do with I think it was razor clams in Cook Inlet, and probably you advised them that they needed to do a customary and traditional finding, as part of that process, and I think we drafted a finding that was for marine invertebrates. And Nick Szabo and probably Chris Gohl and probably several of the others said that they didn't think that there are any traditional uses of crab in any Alaska Native community, maybe in Southeast, but certainly not anywhere else because they were too far offshore and so forth. So they modified, there was a motion to modify the proposal defined for clams only. And Denny raised his hand, and he pointed out that that we had already provided information about a whole range of marine invertebrates that were documented uses by the calendars that Ron Stanek distributed and collected in both Nanwalek and Port Graham, and that one of the criteria was, in fact, a diversity of resources, and that crab was on the list and so forth. And Denny was building this case, and Szabo interrupted him and said, "That's enough, Denny."
Actually, I do remember that.
You remember that?
I do remember that.
And then they voted to make a negative finding for everything but clams. That we fixed that later on.
Right.
But there is an example where,
right, that's a very
where they didn't want to hear it. They just
and that
did
was
not
the worst
want to hear
board.
It.
I mean, that was the bad. Jim Beaton was on there, too.
Yeah, that's right.
The bad old board. So, yeah, you're right. I've forgotten about that. Maybe I blinked it out. It was so hideous.
Yeah. But here's the board would make a customary and traditional determination. The subsistence division didn't.
We provided the worksheet and all the information, and then they worked through it one by one and said, is the information that we have, and it wasn't just us. I mean, there could be public testimony, other staff could have brought, board members themselves knew things about everything, but they would then decide whether the criteria were met, and there was always a debate about whether you had to meet all eight, were some more important than others, was it sort of a combination of things, and you know, it kind of landed that, well, you know, if you didn't have any information about something, you couldn't say no just because of that, and that long-term traditional use and sharing and passing on knowledge across generations was really important.
Well, I guess that gets into the, you know, were the subsistence researchers advocates or, you know, neutral providing data, and if there were, that's where I thought, well, in your research and report, you'd say this is a customary and traditional activity.
I didn't realize that
the boards are the ones.
I think the subsistence division had to be very careful not to say this is a customary and traditional use. They had to say this is shared among households. This is, I don't know, been harvested for generations, time immemorial.
Yeah.
Facts. And then the board would draw the legal conclusion about it being customary and traditional use.
Interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
It would have been a lot easier if the division could have decided.
We never made a recommendation regarding up or down on any CNT or on any ANS amount necessary for subsistence.
I don't really remember much about the subsistence division in front of the board with Tom Lawner. It didn't happen that much before he left and Denny came. But I attribute some of the scrupulousness to Denny because Denny is a lawyer and a smart guy, and he could see that the subsistence division staff had to play that role, and off to the side they might be rooting for our result, but it had to appear neutral on the surface. So and then everybody did that. I mean, that was really really pretty generally done by the subsistence division, which I think in the long run enhanced their credibility a lot, because especially for people who came into the process as time went by, because at the beginning, and the board didn't like it at all and didn't trust the subsistence division, but other people that eventually came in as board members and whatnot, they saw these people providing information, and that is what they were doing, even if in their hearts they were rooting for a particular result.
And despite that, when the repeal initiative was out there, and certain people within the department were advocating to repeal the law and be able to advocate for that as department employees, one of their points was the division of subsistence, and it needed to, you know, to wind up in the trash can, and one of the reasons for that they cited was advocacy.
Right.
So
that was the original bad old days, and those were the people who were going to not see that you actually weren't. Because they probably knew you really wanted a result. I mean, you didn't have, you weren't advocates in general, unless advocates means you present clear, backed up information, mm-hmm. You know, with sources that inevitably would lead to a particular result that nobody, some of the other people didn't want. So.
Right. And I can see, you know, in some cases, a subsistence researcher spending a lot of time in a community or a region and they get to know people, they might have a particular opinion about the issue, mm-hmm. but I'd say they were very careful to not show that at these meetings because right. they had been accused of being advocates and so mm-hmm. they had to be very careful.
And then because really I liked the subsistence division people a lot, and so when I would go after board meetings, you know, when they broke, a group of subsistence division people, including me, would go to Dunkin' Donuts because you would never, ever see board, it's, the board members and other staff and stuff would go to bars and stuff, but so we went to Dunkin' Donuts.
We went to Northern Lights Boulevard, which closed down later on, and I don't think it ever came back.
Well, it was our home for a while.
It was a fun place to go.
It really was.
Yeah.
Yeah, so given that, did you do any collaborative work with the division staff on some of their issues or what they were presenting, or you kept yourself at a distance?
No, I didn't keep myself at a distance. In public, I did. In public, I did. I mean, not in the sense of what would be the wrong connotation here. I certainly, if they had an issue coming up and they asked me how, what's going to be relevant and stuff, I would brainstorm about that. Similarly, I guess if Sportfish Division had come to me and said, we have this complicated commercial allocation and what kinds of things should we be sure to talk about? Mm-hmm. But that happened more with subsistence. It was a more complicated area and much less well-known. So
yeah, like what would be the best way to present to the boards and things like
right.
that?
And what information might
what
be.
What information right. is yeah. relevant, that kind of thing.
I'm trying to think of an example where there's a report that we did run by the Department of Law. I'd have to think because I don't think it was. I can't say whether it was standard operating procedure in the early days or not. I mean, we had Denny, right?
So you had Denny. Why would you need the Department of Law? And I don't think I don't remember ever reviewing reports. I do remember. Okay, if there's going to be this proposal, which is going to, then there's going to have to be information about X. But I don't ever remember reviewing documents presenting the information about X. So, I mean, it might have happened, but it wouldn't have been my bailiwick. So I wouldn't have known what to look for, really, other than spelling errors. And I'm a bad speller, so that wouldn't have been great.
Well, were there times when, you know, the board needed information for something and you went to the subsistence division and said, okay, we need you guys to do research on this or give us this information?
No, the board would have asked at the board meeting and or might have asked the department, but they wouldn't have come to me to ask for the information.
But were there cases where, the board needed more information and they asked the division to do a research project? Or it was already something the division had done research on. It was just saying, give us your data.
Nothing leaps to mind.
Okay. I'm
pretty sure there were times when our staff were asked on the record about some topic that we didn't know anything about or didn't have it at hand. I think there were a few times where we asked for some time to go dig into the written records, not necessarily what we did, but mm-hmm. to see what the literature might say. Yeah. I think there were a couple examples of that. I think actually one was Crab somewhere where it sort of came up and I didn't know, and I poked around a little bit and found some things the next day and came back. And especially later boards had some patience with that kind of
right,
thing.
Right, especially later
yeah,
boards.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hmm. Were you there when John, the Bethel dentist,
White.
John White was chair?
No.
Well, that was later on. Yeah. Okay.
Oh.
Yeah, he was quite the
possibly
character.
I was, I was in Juno, I sort of stopped going to board meetings as much. I was more working on lawsuits and doing stuff with the department. So
yeah.
I do remember him being chair, but I didn't.
He was not necessarily very patient with staff if he couldn't come up with the answer
right off
the top of your head. Comes out of left field and you've got it. Yeah.
What? Do you want me to make something up, Mr. Yeah. Chairman?
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't hostile, but he ran a tight ship. Yeah.
What about the Exxon Valdez oil spill?
I wasn't involved in that at all. The Department of Law was.
Right.
But I don't know if whoever was the... Let's see, who was... Michelle Brown, I guess, was one of the main lawyers for the Department of Law, and I don't know if she interacted with the Subsistence Division at all.
Well, I thought Liza might have been
Liza might still have been
in some of that, but the attorney that I worked with on issues there was a guy named Alex Swiderski, who I think later became a judge.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and...
Because it was, I was
his
in
wife
general,
was
it was
a,
mostly
was
handled
attorney.
Out of the Anchorage,
yeah, Anchorage
office.
Okay.
Yeah, and there was also attorneys contracted to the Department of Law that helped with the litigation. Because when I did my deposition in front of the Exxon attorney, the two attorneys that helped me, including somebody who later became a Supreme Court Justice, Morgan Christen, they were not employees of the Department of Law, and they were
working contract
people. Huh. They were both really, really good. But Alex Swiderski, and there was another guy, why can't I remember his name, who was around for quite a while.
Lance Nelson?
No, I don't remember Lance Nelson being involved. It was somebody not in the fish and game part.
Right.
I can't remember his name now, but... It was those guys. They helped us out a lot. We got that protective order that I was talking about in Steve's interview that basically preserved the confidentiality and anonymity of our data because the data was necessary for fish and game management, and it couldn't be collected if people couldn't be guaranteed as much as we can guarantee anything that it would be confidential. And the judge, Holland, I remember his name now, Judge Holland, bought into that.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking another legal case was the sheep hunting out of Kotzebue.
Oh.
And that was in 85, 86. And I don't know if that was a federal issue or a state issue where it was, you know, a sheep taken out of season, but it was, you know, custom. It was for traditional potlatch or something.
If it was a lawsuit, Liza probably would have handled it because she was still.
Oh, because it was game.
It was game. It wasn't 100% breakdown that way, but it was pretty much she would have. And I don't remember it wasn't another famous case, which I don't remember what it was about, is the Maury case. It wasn't the Maury case, was it?
I don't know that one.
I mean, it's not famous, but it's not like these that we've been talking about. But I don't remember a case with statewide massive implications about that, so it isn't on my radar for some reason.
Okay.
I might have just missed it.
So the big statewide ones would be Madison, Kinaitse, and McDowell.
Those would be the big subsistence ones.
Big three.
For subsistence.
And there were other subsistence ones, like Bobby, which we had good lessons for the game board for sure. But those were the three massively consequential, disruptive ones.
Well, and then Katie John, of course. But nothing really since. It was sort of.
Well, I certainly, because I left. I mean, I was booted.
Oh, since? Oh, there's plenty since.
Right, okay.
But
then
not,
you were involved.
I don't necessarily always try to pay attention.
Sometimes it can be painful, can't it?
Right.
Yeah.
That's why we were asking Jim yesterday. Norman, Steve, and I had seen each other just socially 2 days before that. We think, we don't know how this works anymore. So we were relying on Jim to fill us
in. Well, I don't necessarily know how it works anymore either, because I've been retired for five years, and I haven't been to a board meeting of any kind since then. I I've been tempted to think about showing up at one, at like the Bristol Bay meeting, and, and just sitting in the audience and sort of watching how it works now. I don't know whether I want to do that or not.
The other one, well, we talked about Tiahuanaco, the Western Arctic caribou herd, and that was before
that
you?
That was before me, although it was an important case because apparently the board tried to do the right thing. So that was notable. Mm-hmm. And who was it? Norman told us Bob Hinman came
yeah,
up with
that. Yeah, that's news. That's something to follow up on. Yeah, because you know Bob Hinman is the deputy director of game division. He certainly knew the process.
Right.
And so if somebody had told him, you know, figure out a way that we might be able to do this administratively, he would have done it.
And also, this is painting with a very broad brush, I think that at least some of the people who are dubious about the subsistence law wouldn't mind it if it was like a welfare kind of law. So maybe that maybe Bob Hinman didn't find it inconsistent. He knew that these people needed this stuff. It's not like somebody gets a, I don't know, it's not fair that somebody from Glen Allen gets a permit for Neltina, whereas somebody from Anchorage doesn't. Maybe that appeal to his, okay, this is a welfare, this ought to be a welfare kind of thing, and these people need it. So I have no idea. I do think that some, that could have played into it, but it's pure speculation on my part.
It's a long time ago, too.
Yeah.
And I was thinking the other big one was Neltina caribou herd, but that was game, so you would have been
that
involved.
That was mostly
with that.
Liza would do would do that. I think Denny, you might want to make a note of this and see if it's true. I think he was clerking for the Alaska Supreme Court when the Western Arctic caribou herd came in front of them. And I think there's some footnote in it, which I don't remember, that's significant. That he had something to do with. So ask him about when you talk to him. Ask him about.
Okay.
I might be misremembering.
The other one, and I don't know where I read this, or anyway, the thought that you know, the whole idea of subsistence and limiting and equal access, whereas with fishing, with the CDQs, is that what it's called?
The commercial thing.
It's sort of divided by communities, and they have to get a they get a quota and all that. We do limit access to resources in that case,
but I
don't know the details of it. But if you have any knowledge to compare that,
you should have asked Norman because he worked for those people.
He knows how it worked.
And I can't remember. I know there was some lawsuits that I was involved with. Was the board favoring, this wasn't the CV quota thing, it was a different way of approaching maybe a similar thing, limited a certain fisheries to boats of certain sizes, plus if you fished in some other fishery, you couldn't fish in those fisheries. And so the effect was to, I'm thinking the Hooper Bay, Togiak, small places that relied on fishing near their places wouldn't have big boats from other places coming in, but that was nothing to do with the quota system. And it was also facially neutral, so it didn't say this is a fishery for people from Togiak. It said if you fish in this big fishery over here, you can't fish there. And if you fish with a certain size boat, you can't fish there. Stuff like that. So trying to get around around to the same result. But I don't know how the quota system works.
Yeah, so. I just know that there are limitations in other access issues, but somehow with subsistence it got decided it's equal access.
Well, for commercial fishing, the only way you can have the limited entry system is because there was a constitutional amendment.
Okay.
So that authorized the commercial. And maybe that has something to do with the quota system. I don't know they use the same.
Limited entry is a good word.
Limited entry is needed. They tried to do it, and then they got booted out. This was before my time. And so then there was a constitutional amendment that allowed it. And,
that's why.
And so that's how they can pick certain people to let them do it.
That explains it. Thank you.
Yeah. You were talking, what you're referencing before is the super exclusive areas.
Right? That's right. That's what they were called.
Because I remember sitting in at a board meeting early on, and it was a fish board meeting, and I think it was Nelson Island, where a commercial herring fishery or a commercial rowan kelp fishery was developing, and they wanted to make it a super exclusive area. And Henry Mitchell was there, and there was testimony, and the fish board turned them down, and this was the Szabo board, and they said, well, we're not convinced that the people who live out there are going to be able to develop this fishery, and we need to bring in the big boats in order to develop the fishery, and that's our job, is to develop commercial fisheries. Huh. And I remember Jimmy Huntington getting really angry.
I bet.
You don't remember that.
I don't remember that event.
He was sitting there or
no,
not,
no,
but
no.
Maybe just Gisberg, or maybe nobody.
Right, sometimes we didn't.
But it was pretty tense. And Henry Mitchell was standing in the back of the room just staring at them. And he did it for like 2 days. He just stood in the back of the room, staring.
He has quite a presence. Or had,
yeah,
I don't know, he's still alive, but he was a very
Anyway, so it's another example where the fish board back in those days was not particularly sympathetic to rural interests, whether they were subsistence
or commercial,
some limited source of cash that would help them out. And I think that went to, the court, and I have an idea that they might have won on that, and I think that's the reason that Nick Szabo was not reappointed to the fish board. It wasn't for anything that
just
he did
not
with
his
subsistence.
Obnoxious personality.
It was that was a tough
another
tough
attempt the state made at limiting was the exclusive guiding areas, where a guide was given was the only guide that could take guided hunts to a certain area. And that got tossed out.
Okay.
It was the Osechic case.
Yeah.
Similarly, that it was not equal access.
It was because it was an exclusive. I mean, it was 100% exclusive.
Right.
And it was a closed class. And that was one of the arguments we made in McDowell, is that this wasn't a closed class. If somebody moved to Bethel, they would... You know, it wasn't, but these exclusive guiding areas were just for John Doe or whoever, Mr. Osechek, I guess. Oh, no, Osechek challenged it, so somebody else had an area.
Yeah. I remember when the McDowell case was under development, we were talking about it, there were people in the department who just said, well, with the Osechek case, we don't see how the subsistence law can survive. And, you know, and then the argument was, well, rural residency is not a close, and you or whoever developed that brief made that argument, and they rejected it.
They did,
as I recall, they said something like, "Well, people don't want to live in rural places. There's no economic opportunities. So how can you say that anybody can live there?" That's exactly the point, right?
And it's a kind of a hard. McDowell is a little bit hard to generalize about what the court said because Rabinowitz is clear.
Yeah.
But then there was the main opinion, and then there were two concurring opinions, all of which came down against the law, but for slightly different reasons. So, and also, so even if it wasn't a closed class, it was too imperfect for the impingement on this important right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so were you trying these cases in court? Were you the one in the courtroom?
All three of these terrible result cases, I won at the lower court level all the way up. And Josend? I think there were some... Madison and Josend, those are the two that are together, might have had a preliminary injunction hearing. But other than that, they were decided, all these cases, on summary judgment motions, which is where... both sides argue the law based on the facts and say the facts are not really in dispute, the relevant facts are not in dispute, and you have different ideas about what the law should say. So they weren't like courtroom dramas. There were arguments.
But you were the one there presenting.
The one. Yep. And I won at the lower level on all of them.
So did were you there in person for oral arguments or whatever for the Supreme Court then? in any of these?
The Alaska Supreme Court?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did them. Oh. I did them, yeah. I have a recording, actually, of my McDowell one on my iTunes.
Wow.
Because they give you a recording afterwards, and I thought, well, this is an important case.
And when that was over, what did you think? Did you think you were going to win, or do you think
I don't think it was so clear that we were going to lose. It was Don Mitchell and me against Cherie Jacobus.
Yeah.
And really, I think Don and I did a way better job, and the questions weren't... Sometimes you can tell from the questions the court is asking, but I don't think we could tell. I think we were quite... I mean, we weren't sure we were going to win, but it wasn't clear we were going to lose either.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
And then, what was your response when you lost?
Mostly, damn, this is terrible timing because Steve and I got married in January 1990, and we went off to Hawaii for 2 weeks, and then we got the stay. The state got the stay, so we went ahead and got married and went to Hawaii. In one sense, it was pretty clear what to do. Either the state passed a constitutional amendment or we lost management. I mean, it wasn't like lots of options. And the constitutional amendment part was so political that the Department of Law wasn't really involved in that, other than drafting the constitutional amendment that would solve it. But then it was up to the political equations, and it just never gelled. So in a way, that was off my plate, other than making sure the constitutional amendment wording would cover what we needed it to cover.
And that was largely just allowing residency to be used as a criteria.
As a criteria, I believe that's right.
Yeah.
I don't have anything about that in my files. Yeah, it was fairly simple, and I can't even remember if it was added to the same provision as the limited entry one. Mm. I don't remember where it was supposedly going to fit in the Constitution.
Yeah.
And it isn't in any of my files, so I don't have that.
I don't know. I think that must be hard, that you spent all this time and energy and research preparing your arguments and knowing all the details in and out, and then to lose.
And to have it be such a consequential case.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was huge ramifications. I have been all my life pretty good at compartmentalizing, and I think part of me, what you said, is, you know, like all this work, not just me, but subsistence division work and the AFN supporting us and everybody working to try to get this compliance with ANILCA and maintain state management, which some could argue was a good goal or not, but that was the goal. But then as far as the what do we do now, that part of it was so simple. It was just somebody's got to arrange to pass a constitutional amendment through the House
how it feels to be on the losing side.
Yeah, disappointing. Yep.
Were there any ramifications?
I tell you, McDowell was helped a lot by Rabinowitz's opinion, because he completely agreed with our arguments. So it wasn't like we made idiotic arguments, because he's a smart man.
Right.
So I felt better than if he hadn't. Like in Madison, there was nobody that dissented. It was just not in the statute. And
right.
There was no way to
Case
say
closed.
It was in the statute.
Literally.
But I was just thinking the ramifications. It's like you're the lead attorney on a big case like that. You said it was this monumental case. Lose, or they're, you know, within the department or the politics that come, like, you know, criticizing you?
Oh, no, not within the Department of Law. I mean, people have actually lost worse cases than that, I think. and lawyers are pretty good at knowing that that can just happen.
Yeah.
It was kind of obnoxious that the people on the wrong side of this whole thing would be now smug because, we were right all along.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was obnoxious. But I didn't have to see too many of them. So,
right. So you didn't feel any ramifications with your career? That came
later. No, that came later when Hickel got elected.
Yeah.
And that had nothing to do with what I was doing at the time. That had to do with former animosity.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't know if it was Ron Somerville himself, but it was the Somervillian forces of...
Right.
Who all came in to when Hickel came in.
Right.
And that fishery board member who tried to get you fired, you don't really know what that was about.
I don't know what his pretext was. I'm sure it was because I was forthright and firm. And actually, I told you this was mentioned in my book, so I found a section about it. This is a chapter called "Easy Time Away Allows Better Focus," and in it there was a there's a place where I put in something I developed while we were out on the boat, which was a friend of mine who disagrees with me politically said, well, why don't we each tell each other about what strands make up who we are? And so one of the strands for me was not being liked by certain people can be eloquent evidence of who one is. I came to understand that if I stood for something, I was not always going to be liked and that this was okay. Early on in the Alaska subsistence controversies of the 1980s, I was stunned to learn that one of the state fisheries board members was trying to get me fired from my Department of Law position. At first, I was really hurt and quite devastated. Then someone I admired greatly but did not know at all personally, a somewhat fiery rural leader, came up to me agog during a break in a highly charged Joint Board of Fisheries and Game meeting and asked how in the world I had learned to state things so clearly and firmly and not to be intimidated. His raw, straightforward admiration, without any history of personal contact between us, made a stark contrast to the board member's effort to get me fired, a board member who had been among those taking me out for drinks when it seemed I was just a young, attractive, new to advising the board, assistant attorney general, and not someone perceived as having a certain amount of inner strength and power. So I was ultimately glad the board member was against me and so proud of the compliment. I realized both said a lot about who I was. Mm-hmm. So
that's great.
And so I don't know what, I'm sure it was because I was being straightforward and I wasn't using weasel words and I wasn't giving them wiggle room because the law was pretty damn clear. Yeah. Mandate subsistence law, priority if need be.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does, so. It, you know, I don't really like asking this question, but as a woman at the time, did you feel any... targeting or mistreatment or bias, or I don't know how to say the word.
I was given strong advice by Denny and by John Gisberg to not work on my quilting project at the table, at the Department of Law table. Behind the board, we had a table, and would work there, and we could do things, because if there was nothing to pay attention to at the moment. So I had this quilting project I was working on, and they said, no. Either they did it separately, both of them, and they not very much in agreement with each other. I mean, they weren't at odds, but they said, it's not reasonable, but it just ruins your credibility. Ditch the sewing. So instead, I brought letters I had to answer, and so I pretended I was taking notes, and I wrote when I didn't have anything else official to do, or didn't have to pay attention to the discussion. So that was supportive, but acknowledging the reality that because I was... doing something that looked very feminine, it would undercut me. So,
yeah, that seating arrangement changed pretty. I remember seeing that a couple of times where you were sitting back there, but it wasn't very long after I started working that the
moved up
attorney
to the table.
General person wound up sitting up there. Right. And
maybe we got more active. I'm not sure why, but I do. I know it didn't last very long.
Were you at the fish board meeting? I think it was in Dillingham where Togiak was trying to get sport fishing closed in a portion of the river.
No. I haven't been to a board meeting in Dillingham. I remember that issue, but not from being at the meeting.
That might have been, I wonder if that, I think that was in the 80s, but maybe that was post-McDowell. But
There was a woman named Bonnie somebody who worked in the Department of Law who did some of the fish board
stuff. Oh, yeah.
I forgot her last name, but she took over fish board stuff from not because of me moving to the other, but just because Eliza left, I guess.
Yeah.
And she was the new person.
Yeah, I'll remember her name in a few minutes. But you know, that was an example where it came pretty close that we were right at the line on that one, I think. And you know, it's not for nothing that Bob Wolf's memoir in a sense with the essays is Playing with Fish,
right?
You know, because this was an issue where people in Togiak objected to sport fishing on the upper portion of the Togiak River because it was contrary to their belief that this was abusing fish, and if a fish is giving itself to you, you shouldn't be throwing it back.
It was a catch and release.
Yeah, right. and beyond that was the view that the department was underestimating the mortality connected with releasing a fish. And we had hired a University of Alaska anthropology guy to go out to Togiak and collect some information about that, which he did, and the report was not received very well by others in the department. But I thought of this because of the seating arrangement.
Right.
And at that meeting, for some reason, now all the fish and game people are in one line on one side, and the boards people and the AG and the protectioners on the other side. But for some reason at this meeting, we were put on the other side from the other divisions.
Oh.
And we were providing this information that I said was kind of right on the line in terms of whether the proposal should be supported or not, because the official position was neutral. And afterwards, it was Robin Samuelson. You knew Robin,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
who later was on the fish board, but he wasn't up there. He came up to me and he said, you know, you guys should not be sitting across like that. It looks really, really awful.
The optics are
bad.
Yeah,
I mean, it just makes you look like opponents.
Yeah.
And you've got to deal, deal with that. And he was absolutely right.
Yeah, good observing. Yeah.
So, and I think we brought it up later on, and I don't think it ever happened again. But
that's a good point.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things we've been talking about is the legacy of the subsistence division and, you know, your views on how well it's done, has it provided a service to the state in implementing the subsistence law?
Especially thinking back to when you were active.
Right.
Well, it seems like even today, the kind of research that the subsistence division has put together all along was not there before. I mean, people knew it. Maybe the people in the villages knew it, but it wasn't organized and wasn't available. And so certainly during the time I was there, from what I could gather, nobody knew any of this stuff before this. I mean, the people out there in the world knew their own information,
right,
but there was no consolidation of it and organization of it and packaging of it in a way that could be used by any decision makers. So that was hugely monumental. I mean, the state, for its brief time in being inconsistent with being consistent with ANILCA, was because of the subsistence division data. And for the brief time of having that new statute that worked, it was because the legislature could use the subsistence division data. I think it really shifted the way people looked at people in decision-making positions, looked at the uses. And I can't help but think that is a permanent change that undoubtedly has lasted since then, though I haven't been involved.
It has.
And
if even gotten better.
And so, yes, there's a huge legacy.
Especially in the fish board.
Right.
And they had some really rough times in the beginning and had some, I mean, Bob Wolf's memo about giving everyone a pep talk because things were so awful. I mean, very hard going, but kept it up. And yes, I think it was a very important legacy and a huge gift to the state to have that kind of thing.
So when you say it shifted the way people looked at the uses, did it also change the way people looked at the users?
The way people looked at what?
The users, the people who were fishing or hunting or gathering.
Well, I think
can you put yourself back on mute, Bill?
I can only talk for that probably about the time I was involved with it. And I would say in that span, the board members the board members changed, but also the attitudes changed, and it seems like people took the uses, and thus the users who lived in the places where these were used, more seriously than earlier. Like, they were actual people who had actual uses instead of really all that mattered was commercial and sport. I have no idea what happened since that on that front. So,
yeah, we're just talking the period you were involved.
Yeah,
noticed it.
Not everybody, of course.
Okay, thanks. That's helpful to me because I wrote an article talking about this distinction of use and users, it was actually based on a mistake that was made in an earlier book. But it brought to my mind this real extreme conflict within the state of Alaska, where you've got this emphasis on treating everyone equally, but equality under the law doesn't mean sufficient treatment of the differences amongst the population in different areas. And what we've talked about today in both of the interviews and in yesterday's with Norm is working through these issues. And so I'm very encouraged by your comment you just made. And I think that's a significant tribute to the work of the Subsistence Division and to the work of the legal staff, such as yourself. So I think this has been a good interview.
Well, I agree. I don't know about the legal staff part, but certainly the Subsistence Division part.
And, you know, I think that that has continued to improve, knock on wood. And one example of that is that the Fish Board fairly recently has carved out a portion of their agenda to specifically elicit traditional knowledge from people, and to do that you get a bit more time. It's how to do it is still being worked out, and what you're supposed to provide the traditional knowledge as sort of background to the fishery and overall issues rather than use it as a time to advocate for one of your proposals. Uh-huh. That's what you should do during the
public testimony. And so people have longer to talk.
They get about twice as much time. It's still not very much.
But still, that's such a limited amount of time.
I'll tell you, one of the most painful things I ever saw at a Fish Board meeting was in Sitka. And I think the man's name was Walter Soboloff.
Probably.
Might have been, maybe I'm getting the name wrong, but he was the top elder in Sitka. An old man, and he came to the Fish Board to basically greet them and introduce them to the community, and they cut him off.
And he probably spent a fair amount of his time saying his lineage.
That's right. That was about all. Yeah, but he sat there for a while, somewhat stunned.
I bet.
And I actually told several board members and probably whoever was there for the Department of Law, you know, just I might have even used the word awful. Yeah. You know, that he had really been insulted.
So
isn't there some way, you know, and I don't remember, it wasn't Lance who was there for the Department of Law, but you know, it was basically this comment, oh, you got Pete, everybody the same. If we gave the top elder and among the Tlingits and Sitka in their territory where they've been for 5,000 years, 15 minutes instead of... we'd have to give every Tom, Dick, and Harry the same
minutes.
No, you don't. Right. Let's acknowledge where you are and who's here. So I think this is getting there, you know, a little bit more.
Well, I'd say...
It's the same point that Bill is making about equality versus understanding differences and where so forth.
Well, you go to any place, any event in Juneau, and there's almost always a land acknowledgement, not just in the program, but out loud ahead of time. That's not exactly the same, but it's a kind of a thing.
Right, and that's a new thing. It didn't used to happen. Now, see, I know you weren't there with the drafting of the subsistence law, and obviously there have been controversies with it, but do you think the state of Alaska having a subsistence law and managing subsistence is a good thing, or that it's worked, or from the legal side?
I think it was a good thing because the intent was was one thing, but now how the state subsistence law works, I despite Jim telling a little bit about it yesterday, I can't really picture, so I don't know if it's a good, I'm sure it's good that the division is still gathering data, but I don't know enough about how it works, and I know there are a lot of entities that think they may as well be better under the federal management because the state wasn't doing it right, and I don't know how if there are complaints about the federal management, there probably are.
There are.
So I think I think certainly the intent in the 1986 law and the intent as interpreted by the boards in the 1978 law seems to me a good thing because mm-hmm. it acknowledges we may all be equal under God and under the law, but we're not all equal the way we live, and let's find a way to deal with that. So, yes, I think it's a good thing, though I can't speak to the way it operates right now.
No, but at the time when you were dealing with it and it was having its effect around the state.
Mm-hmm. And that's partly why when Steve said part of the reason he came to Juneau as director was because of a sense of working together. I mean, it was a sense of working together for a good reason, for a good cause. And so I didn't... when I got booted and transferred to the commercial section, I couldn't summon up the same feelings about insurance law. I mean, I'm sure insurance is important to people, but it didn't do it for me.
That same sense of, you know, a group effort and the collaboration and all that?
And that I was less involved with gathering the data, of course, and even making the decisions, but I was involved in helping steer the clients or telling them what the law required or helping them figure out if they wanted to do something, how they could do it. And it seemed like a partnership, like an alliance of working towards something that was a worthwhile goal, which not everybody gets. I mean, you could be a lawyer and, I mean, I have done commercial sport fishing allocation cases that were fascinating intellectually, but I didn't care about them. I mean, they were just intellectual allocation issues and how does this work, and I'm sure it mattered a lot to the commercial fisherman or the sport fisherman, but it didn't affect me the same way that this did.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall back in those days thinking about any missed opportunities that you were witnessing, that something could have been done better or instead of something? It's probably hard to conjure up anything.
Nothing leaps to mind. I mean, there were decisions. Well, gosh, the way they treated Walter Sobolev. If I had been there, I would have
I
said.
Hope that's
but
the
that's
right
not.
Name.
Well, he is. I mean, there, was, that is yeah. not a name that is more famous in the
yeah,
Southeast name.
But,
he's also famous, so he might have just popped into your head.
Yeah,
whoever
I think
he
that
was.
Might be. It could have been some.
Yeah.
Well, I was also thinking in cases that you lose, you go back and think, oh, I should have said this, or oh, I could have had that.
Actually, because of Jim's prompting memo or email about what, I went and read the briefs for those three cases that I wrote. I didn't have everybody else's briefs. I was persuaded all over again. No, and I always viewed my job as a lawyer to do the best, whether it was a commercial sport fish case or what, for whatever side I was on, and I never was on a side that was awful, so that was good for me.
Yeah.
To do the best job I could to present the sort of situation to the court so that they would be inclined, if there was a reason, to rule for my side, and then to give them reasons that they could legally rule for my side. And I think the briefs in these three cases were great, but you couldn't overcome the Ninth Circuit thinking they knew what rural meant. It was so
right.
obvious, and the statute didn't say rural. And then the Supreme Court with their equal access thing. I mean, but I did the best I could, and there wasn't anything else I would have done in retrospect to make them more persuasive. And then, of course, all my briefs, also Don Mitchell was filing briefs on AFN, and he's more snippy than I am, and a little less less diplomatic, but he had his arguments too. So between the two of us, we had a range of styles, and the content dovetailed, but we were just out of luck. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Well, Bill, do you have any other questions or thoughts?
No, I think we should end the interview. I think it's been a good one, and we've gone over
that
2 hours.
Right. Larry, any other things you want to conclude with?
I'm really glad you're doing this, because the subsistence division was so important, and it'd be a shame to not get this stuff down while there are still some of us alive to say it. So.
Yeah, we've missed some really important.